Chapter 53. Right on time, a black SUV stopped in front of the dorm where Murray and Sully were waiting, eagerly. They tossed their gym bags in the back and hopped in. Reynard had said to pack lightly. They would be wearing t-shirts and shorts all weekend. It might be damp and chilly in Durham, but on South Beach, it was all blue skies, string bikinis, and sunshine. It was almost 5 on Friday afternoon. Sully looked at his cell phone, frowned, and whispered,
"It's your mother. For the third time, I can't ignore her calls."
"Ignore them," Murray said.
"I am. They're out of line, Sully. Forgive them."
"They're just concerned, that's all.
I'll call her from the plane."
They arrived at the General Aviation Terminal and met a pilot in the lounge. He took their bags and escorted them onto the tarmac where a gorgeous private jet was waiting. He waved them up the stairs and said,
"Off to Miami, gentlemen."
They bounded up and were met by Reynard holding a bottle of beer. A pretty flight attendant took their jackets and drink orders. Beers all around. In the rear, a comely blonde stood and walked forward with a perfect smile. Reynard said,
"This is my girlfriend, Meg."
"Meg, Sully and Murray." She shook their hands as they admired her deep blue eyes. They settled into enormous leather chairs and absorbed the cabin's rich detail. Meg, whose skirt was tight and short, crossed her legs and Sully's heart skipped a beat. Murray tried not to look and asked Reynard,
"So, what kind of jet do we have here?"
"A Falcon 900. Murray nodded as if his tastes in private aircraft were quite discriminating.
"What's the range?"
"Anywhere, really. We flew to Croatia last year to see a kid. A wasted trip. One stop, I believe. Arnie wants to stop handling players in Europe, though. He has enough here in the States."
The flight attendant appeared with a tray with 2 iced bottles of beer. Meg asked for a glass of wine. The airplane began to taxi as Murray kept asking about what the jet could and could not do. The flight attendant asked them to strap in for takeoff, then disappeared into the rear. 15 minutes later, she reappeared with fresh drinks and asked if anyone was hungry. The thought of eating at 40,000 feet in such luxury was overwhelming, and the boys ordered small pizzas. Meg proved to be quite the basketball buff and quizzed them on their run to the Final Four. Because of Reynard's line of work, she watched a lot of basketball, college and pro, and knew all the players and coaches and even some of the refs. Reynard estimated that he personally attended at least 75 games each season, and Meg was often with him.
"Not a bad life," Murray was thinking,
and quizzed Reynard about his work. Sully checked his cell phone, saw that there was coverage, and stepped to the rear to call Miss Ida. She did not answer. Arnie's sprawling home was on a street near the ocean. It, along with its neighbors, had obviously been designed by cutting-edge architects trying mightily to shock each other. Front doors were taboo. Upper floors landed at odd angles. One was a series of 3 glass silos attached by what seemed like chrome gangplanks. Another was a grotesque bunker patterned after a peanut shell with no glass at all. After 8 months in Durham, Sully had never seen a house there that even remotely resembled these bizarre structures. Arnie's was one of the prettier ones, with 3 levels and plenty of views. The limo stopped in the circular drive and a barefoot butler greeted them. He showed them through the front opening, again no door, and to a vast open space with soaring ceilings and all manner of Calder-like mobiles dangling in the air.
"The party's back there," the butler said, pointing to the rear lawn where a large, well-lit pool welcomed the guests.
"We're going to change," Reynard said, and he and Meg disappeared.
In well-worn jeans, sneakers, and t-shirts, Sully and Murray almost felt overdressed. Everyone wore shorts. Some had shoes. They eased to a corner, found the bar, got another beer, and watched as 2 girls jumped in the pool. Soft rap barked from hidden speakers. Guests came and went into the house and back. Someone said loudly,
"Hey, it's Sully!"
The stranger walked over with a big smile and even bigger handshake. He introduced himself as Julian somebody and said he and Reynard worked together. Every guest had some connection to the game, and at that moment,
Samuel Suleiman was the most famous college player in the country. A crowd soon gathered around him, and he chattered away. Someone brought him a fresh beer. Some girls drifted over. They were attractive and of all shades, black, white, and brown, and all appeared to be no older than 20. Several strutted around in skimpy swimwear, others in tight shorts with revealing blouses. Murray, as always, began flirting. A long table was set up in the main room, and dinner was served. The guests were other agents who worked with Arnie, a couple of executives with the Heat, some coaches in the area, some friends from the neighborhood. The casual gathering gave the impression that in Arnie's world, a party such as this could materialize at a moment's notice. "Where was Arnie?" Murray asked Reynard, who said the boss was flying in and should arrive any time now. Other guests were arriving. Murray recognized Lynn Corby, a guard for the Heat, who had been injured for the past month. The team was on the road finishing up the season. The playoffs would begin in a week. The sighting of Corby made Suli wonder if Niola might show up, but Murray didn't think so. After dinner, a DJ appeared and cranked up the music. A dance floor emerged from the landscaping beside the pool and was soon crowded with gyrating couples. Behind a row of hedges, a smaller party was underway in a large hot tub where half a dozen young ladies skinny-dipped and splashed around while balancing flutes of champagne. Suli and Murray fell into lawn chairs and watched the show. Murray said,
"Suli, old boy, we're a long way from Durham."
They hung out, danced, drank beers, and otherwise partied until after midnight. With no end in sight, Suli said he'd had enough. A porter showed them to their bedroom on the second floor, on a wing that resembled a designer dormitory. They retired to matching single beds and fell asleep, with the sounds of the party still rocking below. Reynard fetched them late the following morning and led them to a deck near the pool. A large canopy shielded the sun and a fan cooled the pleasant air. Arnie Savage was on the phone and jumped to his feet when he saw them. The phone disappeared. He introduced himself, shook hands warmly, and apologized for missing his party the night before. He offered them seats, and within seconds, a young lady was waiting to take their orders. Omelets, pancakes, ham and eggs, avocado toast, you name it. Murray looked at Reynard and asked, "What are you having?" "Poached eggs on avocado toast is always good."
"The best," Arnie said.
"I'll take that too,"
Murray said.
"I like waffles and bacon."
"Me too,"
Suli said quickly. "Coffee and juice all around." Suli had read so much about Arnie that he felt like he'd known him for years. He was usually rated in the top 10 NBA agents, and with his impressive list of clients, he was considered one of the most powerful. They were expecting a high-octane salesman, one ready to promise everything. Instead, they were immediately disarmed by Arnie's deliberate cadence and soft voice. He spoke at three-quarter speed and seemed to dwell on each word. He wanted them to talk, and he hung on every word and never blinked. They talked about their miracle season, the adventures at the Final Four. Of course he had been there. He hadn't missed one in years. The food arrived, and they dug in. Arnie had played in college and still looked game ready. Said he ran 10 miles a day and played a lot of tennis. Between bites, he said,
"So, Suli, I guess it's okay to call you that, right? I mean, half the world knows you as Suli, but do you prefer Samuel?"
Murray blurted,
"Suli's fine."
Samuel nodded.
"Then Suli it is. Mind if I ask about the process in selecting an agent? How far along are you?"
"Just getting started,"
Suli said.
"You're the first. Me and my consultant here thought we would pick out two or three and say hello. Is that the way it's normally done?"
"There's no set way to do things. That'll work just fine."
Murray, now the consultant, said,
"So, tell us where you see him in the draft."
"Sure. My team and I have watched you play, live and on a lot of film, and we've talked to scouts at every level. On the plus side, and there are far more positives than negatives, there is the obvious size, speed, quickness, leaping, shooting, everything, really. In my opinion, you're the perfect age, You're a team player, you smile a lot, and as we all watched, the entire world caught a good case of Sulimania. You handled it beautifully, and every pro team would love to draft you. And the downside? Murray asked, attacking another waffle. Arnie smiled and sipped his coffee. Lack of experience? No high school ball? Only 1 year of college? Or half a year, really. Virtually every other player that will go in the first two rounds has been well-known for years. Those four at Duke played on a national team when they were 15, and everybody saw them. I don't have to remind you that in the world of sports, there are many stories of athletes who came out of nowhere, lit it up for a short time, then faded, never to be seen again. Are you a bolt of lightning, Sully? Some worry about that. I don't. There's also concern about your last game. You didn't play well against Villanova, and some critics couldn't wait to pounce and say you choked under pressure, Murray said. He scored 58 against Duke. I know. You asked about the downside. There it is. None of it bothers me, Sully. I'm convinced you have the body, talent, and brains for a long NBA career. So, where do I fit? Without hesitation, Arnie said, you've seen the projections. Lots of experts out there. We do a mock draft every day in my office and spend hours moving names up and down. There are the four at Duke, two at Kentucky, and Kiki at Oregon, Dokifer at Minnesota, all first years. Then Darryl Whitley at Villanova, Long at San Diego, the big Russian at Gonzaga, and Barber at Kansas. That's 12, and somewhere around there is when your name gets called. Arnie rattled these off as if he had every stat memorized and knew what every GM was thinking. Murray said, so 12 at the highest? 9, maybe 10 at the highest, 15 at the lowest. Definitely first round, Sully. I'll negotiate a 4-year contract with 2 years guaranteed. How much? Sully asked. You know the rookie scale, and you know it depends on where you land, but something like 10 to 15 million is realistic. Sully couldn't suppress a smile. Nor could his consultant. Reynard watched him closely and saw the usual signs of disbelief. Dreaming was unavoidable, but hearing the numbers from a veteran like Arnie was always a shock. Sully put down his fork and took a sip of orange juice. His mouth was suddenly dry. His late father had earned about $200 a month as a school teacher, and for only 8 months out of the year. Arnie waited, took a bite, then continued. I'll take my 4% off the top, standard. When the endorsements start coming, and little will happen the first year or so, I'll guide you through them and take 10%. Again, that's pretty standard. And I guard the money, Sully. I could write a book about pro athletes who've squandered millions and left the game broke. Not my clients. I have an investment team, and we work hard to protect you and your money. My clients do well on the court, off the court, and in the markets. Murray asked, so, you manage the money? I do. My rookie players get some cash up front to adjust to the lifestyle. You're in the NBA now, and certain upgrades are expected. Wardrobe, a sports car, gifts for family and friends, a nice condo. I strongly advise against purchasing real estate until there is a long-term contract and trades look unlikely, though I can't always control the trades. Once you're on your feet and all properly equipped, we decide on how much you need each month. We'll set up an allowance, but it's determined by what you want. We never lose sight of the fact that it's your money, not mine. However, if you decide to take all of it, then you can find another agent. Again, Sully, I protect my clients. If they decide they don't want my protection, then I'm wasting my time. Sully had lost his appetite and was nodding along. Arnie took another bite and gave him plenty of time to ask questions. Hearing none, he continued. The biggest problem is the entourage. You'll attract all manner of friends, new and old, and everybody will want something. You're lucky to have a friend like Murray. Sully laughed and said, he ain't getting nothing. They shared a good laugh. Arnie said, you'll need him, and you'll need his mother. Yes, Ida. I had a long chat with her this morning.
No! You gotta be kidding. Don't tell me she called you.
Murray was shaking his head, humiliated. She did.
I'm so sorry, Arnie. So sorry.
Sorry for what?
She's just butting in. I can't believe this.
Relax, Murray. We had a good talk. She considers you two to be her boys, and she's just being protective.
I'm sorry.
Don't be. My mother died when I was 10 years old. Be thankful she's there. Murray and Sully exchanged confused looks.
What does she want?
Sully asked. Well, she has to see the agency agreement you and I will sign. Fine with me.
I'm an open book, Sully.
There are no secrets, no hidden language. She's a lawyer, and it's a good thing for her to take a look. Any objections?
Sully raised both hands, palms up, and said,
Look, whatever Miss Ida wants is fine with me. I can't say no to her.
Murray said,
She's tough. She probably want to cut you 4%.
Arnie laughed and said, That's not going to happen. I'm sure Miss Ida and I can find plenty of common ground. I've been negotiating with GMs and owners and shoe companies for almost 20 years.
Murray said, And I've been negotiating with her for 20 years. Guess who usually wins?
Well, she did say she wants you two home in one piece. And I promised.
Sully asked, Can we stay till tomorrow?
Sure. Got an idea. I have a 60-foot boat. Nice little rig. Let's take it out this morning and catch some fish.
Awesome.
Chapter 54. Late Monday night, the Central players received emails from Coach Britt calling for a team meeting. By then, it was no surprise he was leaving. Speculation had been rampant. Two websites did little more than track coaching changes in major college sports. And since the end of the season, there had been the usual deluge of gossip about who was getting fired and who was moving up. At least 10 major schools were getting new coaches. They gathered in the locker room at 4 p.m., and the mood was somber. The seniors, Mitch Rocker, Roy Tice, and Dimitri Robbins, were invited, though they had played their last game. They had been recruited by Coach Britt, and he wanted to say goodbye. And Sully was there, too, though everyone knew he wouldn't be back. As always in those dreadful farewells, there was a sense of betrayal. The returning players had committed 4 years of their lives to the coach and his program. Suddenly, his program wasn't good enough for them. He was moving on to bigger things and more money. On the one hand, they were happy for a coach they loved and wanted to succeed at the highest level. On the other hand, they simply wanted him to stay. As a team, they had just accomplished the unthinkable, and the future looked bright. Lonnie made it as brief as possible. He said he had agreed to a 4-year contract at Marquette and would be leaving town soon. He apologized for his departure, for leaving behind the guys he'd recruited, guys he loved, but such is the nature of the game. Everybody moves on. Nothing remains the same. He surprised them with the news that Jason Grinnell would be named his successor. The players were visibly relieved to hear this. Not a word had leaked, and there had been nothing online. Jason was popular with the players and had helped recruit most of them. As his voice began to break, Lonnie thanked them for the great times they'd had together and said he would always remember them. Then he wiped his eyes, smiled at them, and left the room in tears. Jason Grinnell stood and took over the meeting. 2 days later, Sully signed a contract with Arnie Savage and entered the NBA draft. Central promptly issued a statement. No one was surprised. The contract had been combed through by Ida Walker, who wanted a few changes. Arnie's lawyer had emailed it to her, and when she printed it and first held it, she felt like she needed to wash her hands. But the more she wrestled with it, the more comfortable she became. It was as straightforward as Arnie had promised. His lawyer was easy to work with. Hey, they were all on the same team and pursuing the same goals. Sully was slowly beginning to resent her attempts at surveillance and control. For Murray, her involvement was beyond irksome. Though he doubted he would ever have the courage to do so, he was toying with the idea of taking a gap year and working as Sully's assistant. His friend needed him now, and his life was only going to get more complicated. And Murray was seduced by the money, the private jets, the girls, the reflected glory. The sheer excitement of living through an NBA season. Dream on, he kept telling himself. Classes finally ended on May 2nd, and Sully barely made it to the finish line. How was a guy supposed to study when he wasn't returning in the fall? How was a guy supposed to stay motivated and think about 3 more years of college, followed by an eternity in grad school, when he was about to make millions playing his favorite game? It was simply not possible. Nor could he be bothered studying for final exams. The break came in the library one night when he was supposed to be preparing for a biology final, but was really just killing time and staying away from his dorm room. Murray had it for a couple of hours. Reynard texted and asked how things were going. Sully stepped outside into the cool night and called him. When Sully said he was studying for finals, Reynard actually began laughing and couldn't stop. Sully indeed felt rather foolish. "Got an idea," Reynard said. "Instead of worrying about final exams, why don't you ride down with me to Arnie's place for a few days? He's got a couple of NBA assistants in town, and he thinks it would be a great benefit for you to work out with them and talk about the combine. I'll pick you up tomorrow." Without hesitating, Sully said yes. He slept late the following morning and waited for Murray to leave. He crammed as much clothing, toiletries, and other assets as possible into a large gym bag and a backpack. When the black SUV rolled to a stop in front of the dorm, Sully tossed his bags in the hatch and hopped in the back seat. Leaving campus, it hit him hard that he would probably never come back, and that saddened him almost to the point of tears. He had arrived in August, a broken kid still reeling from the horrors at home, uncertain who in his family was still alive, if anyone. His father's death had been confirmed, but the rest of them were missing. Coach Britt had offered a sympathy scholarship, one that had paid off nicely. He thought of Beatrice and how disappointed she would be to see him leaving school, but he couldn't worry about that now. She might understand one day. He waited until he was at South Beach before he texted Murray. "In South Beach at Arnie's for a few days. Please don't tell your mother. All good." To which Murray replied, "Douchebag? What about final exams?" "What about them?" "I'm telling Mom." Arnie's impressive spread did not include his own basketball gym, so he borrowed one from a private school around the corner. Late in the afternoon, on the drive to the gym, Reynard explained that Arnie was in Philadelphia meeting with Darryl Whitley of Villanova. If he signed him, the company would have 2 first-rounders, every agent's dream. Van and Herman were shooting baskets and waiting for them. Introductions were made, and they seemed delighted to meet Sully. Van was once an assistant with the Mavericks, and Herman once scouted for the Magic. They were somewhere in Arnie's orbit, but their positions were not clear. Van took training seriously, and Arnie had asked him to guide Sully through 30 minutes of stretching and slow movements, and to emphasize that the routine was now a part of his daily life. Once he was properly loosened, they began shooting drills. After days off, it felt great to bounce a ball again and take some shots. During a break, they talked about the combine. Van thought it was a good idea. Herman had reservations. Arnie had not yet decided whether Sully should participate. About 50% of his clients did so, and he was known to be less than impressed with the event. Each year, the top 60 to 70 draft hopefuls were invited to the NBA Draft Combine, a 3-day, media-heavy beauty pageant. The players were measured in every way possible: height, with shoes and without, weight, body fat, agility, wingspan, speed, hand size, and vertical leaps, both standing and running. There were shooting contests, light scrimmages, lots of interviews and preening for the press. Sully was eager to go and strut his stuff. Herman said it wasn't a good idea. His stock had never been higher. Why run the risk of a bad workout? The practices continued each day, once in the morning and again late in the afternoon when the gym was available. The cast of coaches and players changed almost daily as Arnie's pals came and went. Some lived in the area, but most were passing through, always on business related to basketball. The longer Sully stayed at Arnie's sumptuous pad, the longer he wanted to stay. His finals were over, as if they mattered. School was out, and Murray, his consultant, was hard at work hauling and stacking boxes for the food bank at $8 an hour. He ordered a late breakfast and ate by the pool with whoever happened to stay in the house the night before. He met an incredible collection of coaches, scouts, former players, other agents, reps from shoe companies, and quite a few folks whose jobs were not well defined. Reynard whispered that most were hangers-on, guys looking for a cushy job in someone's entourage. Arnie was rarely at home. He was on a jet almost every day and relied on his staff to manage the house and the ever-changing lineup of guests. Sully really had no place to go. He leaned on Reynard to make sure he was not overstaying his welcome, to which Reynard laughed and said, "Come on, Sully, you're a first rounder. Primos can stay forever." He talked to Murray every day and Miss Ida occasionally. He called his mother every Wednesday morning, but had not mustered the courage to tell her about his change in plans. He slept late most mornings, took long walks on the beach, spent at least an hour pumping iron, and worked out with various coaches twice a day. When Arnie popped in for a quick stayover, they talked about the draft and the projections. Sully, quite naturally, was keen to know where he might land, and thus where he would be living in the years to come. There were 30 teams from coast to coast, and some cities had more appeal than others. Not that it really mattered. The money would be glorious wherever he landed, but it was one thing to be a star for the Celtics or Lakers and something else to play for Sacramento. Like all players, he was dreaming of a lucrative contract with a storied franchise, one in a huge television market. Arnie talked to general managers and scouts all day long and was still of the opinion that Sully would go in the middle of the first round. Brooklyn, Denver, and Houston looked likely, but things could change in an instant as the draft neared. Each year brought a bewildering flurry of trades that sent players packing from one team to another. In early May, Arnie decided that the combine was not a good idea after all. The scouts had seen enough of Sully. Indeed, no college player that spring had generated more interest and more footage than him. His speed, quickness, leaping, shooting were all well documented, and the combine would only be more of the same. A bad workout, or one that did not meet lofty expectations, could only harm his stock. Sully was disappointed, but trusted his agent implicitly. Then Arnie was gone again, off chasing another deal. Sully begged Murray to hop down for a weekend of parties and girls, but his parents had him handcuffed to his job at the food bank. Sully met a girl. Her name was Valerie, but she went by Val or Valley. Either one would work. She was one of the girls who hung around the pool in a skimpy bikini and enjoyed showing off her well-toned legs and abs. She said she had played basketball at South Florida until a knee injury ruined her career, and she was quick to show him the scar on her leg, the only blemish on an otherwise perfect body. They spent the first night together in Sully's room and had a late breakfast by the pool. The second night, they went to her small apartment around the corner and rarely came up for air. She said she was 24, sold real estate, and worked her own hours. By day three, Sully was thoroughly smitten. Day four was a Wednesday, and he slept late and forgot to call his mother. If Reynard had been around instead of on a plane, he would have warned Sully that the girl was probably trouble. Arnie's universe attracted many young ladies who certainly livened up the parties, but many of them were stalking the money and the big life. Arnie knew better than to get involved. He viewed his home as the entryway for his clients, a transition from the shelter of a campus to the glitzy world of big-dollar entertainment. Once they became professionals, they would face more temptations than any college freshman could possibly imagine. He felt obliged to help them get ready. As lenient as he was, Arnie tried to watch everything. His laid-back staff monitored their guests, took notes, and reported to him. Sex, booze, and pot were to be expected, and there was plenty of it. But if the harder stuff was being passed around and consumed, Arnie wanted to know about it. He had banned several dealers and bad actors. Same for gambling. If a player of his had a weakness for the spreads and tables, he did not hesitate to get involved. Arnie was informed that Sully had a girl, and she appeared to be a stalker. He gave the word to watch them, as closely as possible. Chapter 55. The draft was held on June 8th at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. Sully invited Murray to the party, and he eagerly said yes. Sully also invited Murray's parents, but they declined. They didn't want to spend the money and still disapproved of him leaving college. Sully only made matters worse when he offered to pay their travel expenses to New York and back. They found the offer insulting, but held their comments. They would never, under any circumstances, spend money earned by young Samuel, nor would they humiliate him by rebuking his genuine effort to include them. As Ida said, "He just doesn't know any better." They politely declined, citing work obligations. Valley didn't make the trip either, though not from a lack of trying. Arnie made it clear that, while the trip was planned as a celebration, there would be important business at hand, and he did not want his prized client distracted. He did not want the woman near Sully when they discussed contract negotiations. Sully whispered to Reynard that, frankly, he was relieved and needed a break from the girl. At Reynard's invitation, they detoured their jet to the Raleigh-Durham airport and picked up Murray, a guy who both Reynard and Arnie felt was a good influence on Sully. Arnie and company arrived a day earlier and set up camp on the top floor of the Latitude Hotel, a swanky five-star place 3 blocks from Barclays. In the penthouse suite, a buffet and bar was set up for anyone who wandered in. Along with Sully, Arnie had signed Daryl Whitley from Villanova, a projected top-10 pick, and Devontae Lyon from Auburn, another 19-year-old who turned some heads at the combine. With 3 potential first-rounders, Arnie was the agent of the moment, and his headquarters became a hive of activity as team officials, scouts, reporters, players, coaches, and women came and went or just hung around to soak up the action. Daryl Whitley arrived with a big smile and a bear hug for Sully. They had last seen each other in Phoenix, in Central's last game. Daryl introduced his 2 brothers and 2 friends. Sully had only Murray in his entourage. How many would be enough? He would need to ask Reynard. Devontae Lyon appeared, said hello, and introduced 3 of his own men. Sully really began to feel inadequate. The guys were in a fabulous mood and hung out for hours. Arnie had them booked for a fine dinner, but afterward, they were on their own. Daryl said he knew the city, and they could hit the clubs. The draft was televised live on ESPN and live-streamed on The Vertical. In Durham, Ernie closed the door of his cramped office and watched it on a small TV. Ida went to her conference room at Legal Aid and watched it with her staff on a much larger screen. At South Beach, Valley went to a sports bar with some girlfriends and started drinking an hour before the draft. At Arnie's home in South Beach, everyone, staff and guests, gathered in the small cinema in the basement and waited for the fun. Lonnie Britt watched from a hotel room in Des Moines where he was chasing a star recruit. Echo was home in Cincinnati and sitting in the den with his 15-year-old son. Former teammates, both from the South Sudan summer team and NC Central Eagles, tuned in to watch with anticipation and great pride as their beloved friend became a millionaire. Sully and Daryl had invitations to the green room, a staging area in front of the draft podium where they, along with their agents, families, and a few friends, waited for their magic call. The green room allowed the draft to move along nicely as the top picks, after hugging those who loved them, bounded up the steps and onto the stage where they held their new team's jersey and posed with Commissioner Adam Silver. The invitations were carefully handled because of the possible embarrassment of a top player waiting and waiting and then finding himself relegated to the second round. This had happened, and to avoid it, only the top 20 or so were invited. The chosen gathered and slapped hands and ribbed each other, all trying to appear calm and cool and not the least bit nervous or concerned with what team would call their names, make them rich, and launch their spectacular careers. Sully sat between Arnie and Murray, who seemed even more jittery than his friend. Imagine just being in the same space with 20 guys his age, all of whom were about to start signing big contracts, and some of whom would even become all-stars, even legends. The first pick went to the Timberwolves, and Adam Silver announced the name of Tyrell Miller of Duke. The green room exploded with applause as everyone congratulated the top pick. Tyrell posed with the commissioner and smiled for the cameras. The next four picks went exactly as projected. After the fifth, Arnie, who was watching it all without notes and with a pleasant cockiness, said to Daryl,
"You're next, big guy."
Cleveland chose Daryl, and as he took the stage, Arnie whispered to Sully,
"They'll trade him tomorrow to Indiana."
Sully had no idea how to respond. The draft, with its lottery picks and especially with its deal-making and trading, was at times incomprehensible. Each selection sent dominoes falling in different directions. When Phoenix took Antonio Long from San Diego State, Arnie whispered to Sully,
"You're going to Detroit, but they'll trade you to Washington."
"Now?"
"No, number 9. How does Washington sound?"
"Where do I sign?"
Sully instantly liked the idea of Washington because it was a city he'd actually seen. Except for the March trips to Dayton, Memphis, and Phoenix, he had never left the East Coast. Durham was not far away. The Walkers would be practically next door. He'd seen the campus at Howard, the South Sudanese embassy, some of the monuments. Yes, Washington would work just fine. When his name was called as the 9th pick, he stepped onto the stage, and some fans in the crowd began chanting,
"Sully, Sully, Sully."
As his players partied in the big city, Arnie worked well into the night on the trades that sent Daryl Whitley to the Indiana Pacers and Sully to the Washington Wizards. At 7 the following morning, he had breakfast with Washington's GM and ironed out the contract, a 4-year deal worth $14 million, with half guaranteed. Flying home, Sully decided he needed a break from South Beach. He got off the plane with Murray at Raleigh-Durham and said goodbye and thanks to Arnie and Reynard. From the sleek Falcon, they walked through the private terminal to the parking lot and to Murray's little blue pickup truck that was so old, the odometer had stuck at 220,000 miles. The automated parking meter demanded $18 on a credit card, and Sully happily paid. Driving away, he asked,
"Did you hear the part about the loan?"
"Not all of it." "Arnie advances some money?"
"Yeah. I told Reynard I didn't have a car, and he said no problem. Arnie will loan me $100,000 now, and I'll pay him back in a month when the first check comes in."
"Is that legal?"
"Reynard says it is. Says some agents loan players money long before the draft, and that's not exactly legal."
"Yeah, that kid from Arizona State got caught a few years back, didn't he? The NBA decertified the agent and he filed suit. It was a big scandal."
"Well, Reynard says it's okay now because I'm out of school and officially a pro. How do you like that?"
"Sounds okay. I guess we're going car shopping as soon as you pass the driver's test.
All that. Look, Murray, here's the deal. I need some help. I need to buy a car and find a place to live in D.C., right? I need to do a lot of things, and they're all pretty intimidating. I want you to help me out, at least for the rest of the summer."
"You trying to hire me?"
"That's it. Reynard offered to help, but he's a busy dude, and I trust you, Murray."
"What do you say?"
"How much?"
$8 an hour?"
Both roared with laughter that went on and on, and when it died down, they rode in silence for a while. The thrill and disbelief and giddiness of the past 2 days began to soak in. Murray finally said,
"You'll have to convince Miss Ida. She won't like it. I bet she likes it a lot more now, with 14 mil on the way. Plus, I can talk her into it. She thinks I'm special."
"You are special, Sully.
Still Samuel to you."
"Whatever."
More silence followed. Then Murray asked,
"So what kind of car are you thinking? A Ford Explorer? That SUV?"
Murray laughed and said,
"No, no, Samuel. You don't sign for this kind of money and drive a Ford."
"I've made up my mind. Coach Grinnell has one, and he let me drive it."
"Coach Grinnell is married with 3 kids. You're in the NBA, Samuel, and you can't drive a Ford. You need some fancy sports car, like a Porsche."
"I'm not ready for that. Plus, they cost too much. I saw a Porsche online for over $100,000.
"So?"
So I picked out a Ford Explorer for only $40,000.
Wow, you have so much to learn.
They stopped at Wendy's for burgers and fries, then drove to the legal aid office where Sully got a hero's welcome. Miss Ida had tears in her eyes as she hugged him and showed him off. When they were alone in her office, she got down to business. She was pleased to hear of the trade and that he would be living so close. She explained, with little room for questions or disagreement, that she would prepare a simple will that would leave everything in trust for his mother and brothers.
I never thought about that, Sully admitted.
There are a lot of things you haven't thought about, but I have. Health insurance, your visa, other stuff. When do you expect to sign the contract and get the money?
In about a month.
Okay. The amended contract you signed with Mr. Savage requires that 10% of the money comes into your bank account. He keeps the rest for allowances and investments. You understand this?
Yes, ma'am.
So you'll need to add the name of someone else to your account in case the money needs to be accessed. This person can't touch it unless something happens to you.
Why are you worried about something bad happening to me?
Because I'm a lawyer and you're my client. It's my job to worry about everything.
Come on, Mom, Murray protested.
Just do as I say, okay?
Annie's loaning me $100,000 until the big money comes in.
I assume that's legal?
It is, Murray said.
He needs to buy a car. Wants a Ford Explorer. That's up to you,
Sully said. I'd like to send some money to my mother.
We'll talk about that. I'm not sure it's safe. She's already been robbed once.
But I want to help her.
I understand, Samuel. So do I. We'll figure it out.
Can I sponsor her now and get them out?
Let's talk about that later. I'm doing court in half an hour. We'll talk tonight. What would you like for dinner?
A bottle of champagne?
You'll get iced tea. Something to eat?
Yes, that baked lemon chicken you do with the mushrooms and sauce?
She smiled and said,
whatever you want, Samuel.
Chapter 56.
The excitement of shopping for a new vehicle was crushed when Sully flunked the driver's test. He did okay on the road, though still mortified in 8 lanes of traffic, but he missed too many on the written. He was embarrassed and admitted to Murray that he had found studying difficult. He had been distracted and did not take the exam seriously. Miss Ida was amused by it and admitted to Ernie that the humiliation was probably a healthy blow to his expanding ego. The two agreed to allow Murray to work for Sully for the remainder of the summer and run interference. He did need help on so many fronts. He was entering an exciting new world, but one with many potential pitfalls. And truthfully, there was no way to tell Murray that stacking tons of food in a warehouse was more important than helping a friend. It was an opportunity so unique that they put up only token resistance. The day after the exam, Murray borrowed the family sedan and took off to D.C. with Sully. They found a room at a downtown hotel and began scouting out swanky condos and apartment buildings. Sully wanted something large with plenty of bedrooms for his mother and brothers, but Murray talked him down. He should start small and move up when necessary. The prices for all of them, large and small, were outrageous. Sully was overwhelmed with the process, but excited at having such a nice space all to himself. Murray convinced him to put down a $5,000 deposit for a new, unfurnished 2-bedroom apartment in City Center, not far from Capital One Arena. The lease was for 12 months. They stopped by the Wizards' headquarters and met the front office, all of whom were thrilled to meet their new star. They had lunch with the GM in a fancy restaurant. Sully took a call from the owner, a private equity swinger who had bought the team 4 years earlier for $900 million, according to online business magazines. The owner was eager to meet him and wanted lunch when he was back in the country. He welcomed him aboard and promised a great future together.
The Rancheroo Reggae and Rap Music Festival was held in June every year at the Acropolis Resort on Paradise Island in the Bahamas. In addition to attracting tens of thousands of wild fans from around the world, it had become known for getting the biggest acts in hip-hop and island music.
It was also a favorite of celebrities, the place to be seen and often touched by adoring fans. Murray had heard of it, Sully had not. But the night before the draft, Daryl Whitley and his gang were talking about the party while they hung out in a Brooklyn nightclub. It was a 3-day blowout with lots of girls, many from Europe. As soon as they returned from Brooklyn, Murray mentioned it to Sully and the two checked it out on social media. They drooled over the thousands of photos and it became abundantly clear that the festival was not to be missed. It was favored by plenty of actors and pro athletes, some big NBA names wanting to blow off steam after the season, and some football players taking a break before their training camps. And the lineup of singers and musicians included virtually every name they could think of. Sully mentioned it to Valley, who, not surprisingly, was all in. He talked to Whitley, and the two of them devised a plan. They would invite Reynard and lean on him to get a jet. Two first-round draft picks could not be expected to arrive on commercial flights. The day after they returned from the house-hunting trip to D.C., Sully mentioned over dinner that he needed to see Arnie in South Beach and discuss some endorsement proposals. Murray should go, too. They did not mention the festival to Ida and Ernie because they did not want the drama. Sully was growing weary of their nosiness, and Murray was itching to return to Arnie's place in Miami. The following day, they flew down on Delta and arrived at the mansion in a lowly cab. Reynard was excited about the trip and had secured tickets and accommodations, along with an airplane. Arnie, who was divorced, had attended the festival 2 years earlier and said he might join them later. Whitley arrived with Jared, one of his brothers, and Reggie, his manager. Murray liked that title, and from then on introduced himself as Sully's manager. They slept late the next morning, then loaded into two limos for the ride to the airport where a sleek Gulfstream 6 was waiting. Their party consisted of Sully, Murray, Daryl, Jared, Reggie, Reynard, and his girl Meg, and Valley. For good measure, Sully had invited two of Valley's friends, Tiff and Susan, a couple of attractive former athletes who hung around Arnie's pool. A total of 10 on a jet that could seat 15. The flight attendants were pouring champagne before they buckled in. More bottles were opened and consumed during the 55-minute flight to Nassau. There, a string of colorful limos waited to collect the rich and famous who were arriving by the dozens. They checked in at the Acropolis and found their rooms. Sully's grand suite had two bedrooms, one for him and Valley, the other for Murray, Tiff, and Susan. The sleeping arrangements were not exact, but no one seemed to care. There were at least 3 sofas in the suite. They had a long lunch at a massive buffet near one of the pools and enjoyed people watching. The concerts started around 2, no schedule was strictly adhered to, and a mob gathered around the open-air stage. Loud rap echoed throughout the resort, which had 1,000 rooms, no fewer than 8 pools, water slides, hot tubs, saunas, 3 casinos, and restaurants and bars everywhere. Fans poured in, few of them over the age of 30, and various languages could be heard. Sully was often recognized and proudly posed for photos. It was unbridled hedonism, with seemingly no rules. Murray liked cards, especially blackjack. And late in the afternoon, when they finally lost the girls, he and Sully slipped into a casino for a few hands. It was much quieter at the tables, and they appreciated the retreat from the music. Sully spotted Alan Barnett of the Knicks playing all alone at a high-end table. He was rumored to be one of the biggest gamblers in the NBA and a hellraiser to boot. Rudy Suarez, the all-pro quarterback for the Vikings, stopped by and said a quick hello to Barnett. How cool was that? Sully couldn't wait to start playing and winning and meeting other famous athletes like himself. He lost $500 in his first hour and took a break. It would take a long time for him to adjust to burning cash. Murray, though, was winning big and didn't want to leave his table. Sully went to a bar, got a beer, and watched the action on the floor. After dark, the festival crowd swelled to capacity as 30,000 rowdy fans packed around the stage. There was no seating, just a crush of humanity, with each person holding a drink and bouncing to the relentless, pulsating beat. The night's headliner, Doc Rip and his Bad Boys from Philly, were scheduled for 8. They went on at 10, and the music got even louder, the crowd even rowdier.
Sully was in the thick of it, dancing with Valley, making out, groping, and taking an occasional break at a bar. When the music stopped at 2 a.m., the crowd relaxed and hit the bars. Sully and Valley were drenched and exhausted. They went to his suite, showered, and fell asleep. There was no sign of Murray. They slept until noon and had brunch and champagne by a pool in a secluded part of the resort. Murray found them and was quick to report that he was up $4,000 at blackjack. Sully observed that maybe it was time to cash in his chips, but he had bigger plans. He ate with them as they watched the people. After he left, they changed and jumped in the water for a lazy afternoon by the pool. Daryl, Jared, and Reggie found them, as did Tiff and Susan. The men could not help but gawk at the endless parade of string bikinis. The second night was similar to the first, with one notorious act after another. During a break, Sully bumped into Daryl, who informed him that he had met Wazy Starr, a TV actress, and she and some friends were planning a late-night party in their suite. Sully and Valley were tired of the music and the crush of people, and eventually made their way to the party on the 18th floor. The suite was twice the size of Sully's and was packed with people he did not know. Murray was not in the crowd. Jared Whitley rescued them and introduced them to Wazy, who was stoned out of her mind. A thick fog of marijuana smoke hung just above their heads, and everyone seemed to be hitting a joint. Valley took one, gave it to Sully, and he took a hit. At a dining table, some Hollywood types were laughing over lines of coke. A waiter appeared with a large tray of plastic cups filled with some sort of rum punch. Valley grabbed two, gave one to Sully, and they drifted to another group. Someone recognized him, and he smiled for a camera. He was lightheaded, but thoroughly enjoying himself. A tall blonde asked for another photo, and Sully happily held her close. Valley eased away, looking for another drink. The blonde said her name was Jackie, and she worked in film. She tugged his hand and led him to another room where the music was louder. Sully looked around, wanting to find Valley, but she was nowhere in sight. Jackie clung tight and, at the first chance, kissed him on the lips, then asked him where he was sleeping that night. "In his room," he said. She asked for the number, and he laughed it away. She grabbed two rum punches off a tray and handed one to him. She reached into a pocket and pulled out some small pills.
"Ever try these?"
she asked.
"What are they?"
"Molly's, and they're wonderful. A couple of these and you can go all night long."
She took one, swallowed it, and washed it down with the drink. If she could do it, so could he. Sully knew that Molly was another name for ecstasy, a drug he had only heard about. But for a little pot here and there, after the season, he had no experience with any drugs. She handed him three more and said,
"Save these for later. I'll come find you."
He took them and quickly stuffed them in a pocket.
Jackie said, "I see trouble."
Sully turned around and saw Valley at the door, talking to another girl. Jackie said,
"Let's hook up later, okay?"
"Sure,"
he said, eager to get away from her. He found Valley, who did not seem irritated, and they decided to leave the party. They returned to the concert where everyone was dancing. Sully began to feel sharper, happier, quicker on his feet, and his vision, blurred by alcohol and pot, was suddenly sharper. Valley was all over him and at one point asked,
"Who was that girl?"
"Don't know, babe. Never saw her before."
Sully danced like crazy and felt he could take the stage and belt out a few numbers of his own. He had never felt so exhilarated, so invincible. When Valley left to fetch drinks, he followed behind her and quickly swallowed another Molly. When the music ended, they made their way to the suite, where Murray had another party in the works. Tiff and Susan were dancing by themselves while four guys Sully had never seen before watched and egged them on. Sully suddenly felt dizzy, lethargic, and lead-footed. Though he had been sweating for hours, he noticed that his forehead was extremely warm. Not to be outdone, Valley stripped out of her tight T-shirt and began dancing with her friends. Murray started dancing with them as another group arrived with bottles of champagne. The party was too much fun to miss, so Sully eased into the bathroom and swallowed another Molly.
Chapter 57.
Murray woke to screams. Valley was standing in his door, hysterical. "He's not moving! He's not moving! Do something, Murray!" He found a pair of gym shorts, pulled them on, and almost fell over. His head was splitting and his vision was blurred, but suddenly none of that mattered. He raced to the other bedroom where Valley stood gawking at Sully on the bed, partially covered by a sheet. He was wearing gym shorts and nothing else, and he was stiff as a board. Murray jumped on the bed and shook him vigorously while he pleaded with him to wake up. Tiff and Susan watched in horror as Murray tried everything to revive him. Finally, he stopped and backed away, and the four of them gawked at the lifeless figure.
"What did you give him?"
Murray yelled at Valley.
"Nothing, absolutely nothing. He was drinking and there was a little pot, but nothing. I swear, Murray, I gave him nothing and I didn't see him take anything."
He called the front desk and pleaded for a doctor and an ambulance. He called Reynard's cell, but there was no answer.
"Get dressed,"
he barked at the girls, and he pulled a sheet over his friend. He sat on the edge of the bed and started sobbing. Two medics rushed in, followed by a man in a dark suit, security. As Valley, Tiff, and Susan sat on the sofa and wiped their faces, and with Murray hovering, they checked him with a stethoscope and grimly shook their heads. A second man in a suit, the house detective, arrived and surveyed the situation. He began asking questions. None of them had given the deceased any drugs, they swore. The detective did not believe them. Murray assured him that his friend was not a drug user. Sure, they had been drinking, and too much, and they had smoked pot, but nothing more serious. He did not believe them. When Reynard finally arrived, he almost fainted when he realized what was happening. The detective saw a pair of shorts in a chair and asked who owned them. Valley said Sully had worn them the night before. He went through the pockets and found a single pill. One look, and he said,
"Ecstasy. Where did you get it?"
The four and Reynard were clueless, and no one believed them. They wrestled his body onto a stretcher, one built for average people, but not long enough for a man who stood 6'8". They covered him with sheets and tucked them tight, but his bare feet dangled off the end.
"Don't leave this room," the detective growled as he followed the stretcher.
When they were gone, Reynard looked at Murray and said,
"We have to make some calls. I'll call Arnie, you call your mother. We have a PR guy who will prepare something. It's going to be awful."
"It already is,"
Valley said, sniffing. Murray's thoughts were an incomprehensible mash of fear, blame, disbelief, dread, loss, and excuses. The only thing that was clear was that he could not imagine calling Miss Ida. He finally stood, wiped his cheeks again, walked to the other bedroom with his phone, and closed the door. Ida left her office in tears and drove home where Ernie was waiting. They were almost too stunned to speak, so they sat in their dark den with ESPN on mute, waiting for the news to break. At 12:02, a bulletin interrupted SportsCenter, and there was the smiling face of Samuel Suleiman, his death in the Bahamas now confirmed. Age 18, dead from a possible overdose. The news spread fast, and their phones began buzzing. Echo Lamb was in Juba, scouting talent for his summer under-18 team and getting it ready for the showcase, when his wife called with the news. He went to a locker room and closed the door. Later, he sat his players down and told them that Sully, their new national hero, was dead. Lonnie Britt was in his car on a Milwaukee freeway when he took the call from Jason Grinnell. He barely managed to pull onto the shoulder, where he sat for a long time and tried to collect his thoughts. On campus, a group of students gathered in front of the Nest and sat on the front steps, crying. It was a Sunday in June, and the gym was locked. Other students drove by and joined them. Two more showed up with the first bouquet of flowers and a poster with Sully's smiling face in the middle of it. Handwritten above in bold letters were the words, "So long, Sully. Love always." The crowd grew, and before long a newsman from a Durham station stopped with a crew sniffing for a story, but the students refused to say anything on camera. After being released by the police, Reynard got his group together, and most of them left Nassau as soon as possible. He and Murray stayed behind to do whatever one does with a dead body. On the flight home, the Gulf Stream was as somber as a morgue. Arnie passed them somewhere over the Atlantic. He and his lawyer had quickly chartered a smaller Lear and were sprinting to Nassau. Reynard was forbidden from leaving the hotel and couldn't meet them at the airport. They took a cab to the resort and were briefed by the police, who were still investigating. They had recorded statements from all those around the deceased and were still looking for an unknown woman, an American, tall and blonde, who was seen briefly with Sully last night. The body was at the morgue and awaiting a decision about an autopsy, which could take up to 2 weeks. However, in some cases, the autopsy could be expedited. There was little chance the police would release the body to be sent home for an autopsy, but that decision would be made by the governor. Arnie's lawyer hired the largest law firm in Nassau, one with plenty of connections. He wasn't worried about criminal prosecution. Indeed, so far the only possible crime was possession of illegal substances by the deceased himself. Arnie, though, had learned years ago that it was always safer to lawyer up. Jackie heard the news as it roared through the resort. She whispered to her best friend that it was time to head back to the States. The death was certainly sad and shocking, but the festival was in its last day, and the party must go on. The music began at 2. After the initial numbness, Echo began to attach one thought to another, and he was worried about Beatrice. It was unlikely she would hear the news. How could she? Where would it come from? But Sully had become such a famous person throughout his country, and with 4 million South Sudanese refugees scattered in camps and settlements, there was a chance that the news could make it all the way to Rhino Camp South. He called Christine Moran's cell, but there was no service. He waited an hour and tried again. No service. Being a Sunday, maybe things were slower. She answered the third time, and Echo reintroduced himself. They had met briefly in early December when he visited the camp. She said that she remembered him, then listened as he broke the awful news. Then he asked the mother of all favors. Would she find Beatrice and tell her Sully was dead? Christine was horrified at the thought and quickly declined. Echo pleaded with her and tried to explain that there was no one else to do it. He was in Juba coaching a team and he couldn't leave. Who else in the world could even get to Rhino? Christine said she would consider it but needed some time. She rang off and immediately called the Doctors Without Borders office in New York. Of course, it was closed on Sundays. She called a DWB friend in Paris, at home, and asked him to verify the story. She said her coverage was not good and gave him a sat phone number to call back in 1 hour. He did so and verified the death. By then, Christine realized that she had no choice. She had seen more death than most war veterans, and she had seen it so many different ways, and she thought she was hardened enough to handle anything. But not this. She had come to know and admire Beatrice. Telling her that her oldest son was dead was unthinkable. She huddled with 2 nurse friends, and they decided it would be best to do it in the hospital, in a private area where Beatrice and the boys could grieve. There would be sedatives available. Christine thought about taking one. She sent an errand boy to fetch the family. By late Sunday, several hundred students were at the nest, hugging, crying, supporting each other. Dozens of bouquets covered the front steps, and posters honoring their hero lined the sidewalk. Candles were passed out to be lit after dark. Ida called the mayor and asked for 2 patrol cars to be parked in front of their house. There had been some traffic, a few knocks on the door, and they were in no mood to deal with reporters or anyone else. The television had been turned off. Jordan was flying in from Houston, where she was spending the summer clerking for a law firm. Brady was heading home from Boston. And Murray was at the resort waiting for the authorities. It wasn't clear who would make the next few decisions, but the governor had been mentioned a couple of times by the police. As they killed time, Murray, Arnie, and Reynard agreed to stick together and not point fingers. Sully had wanted to attend the festival. He wanted to celebrate and have some serious fun. It was his idea to join forces with Whitley and ask for the jet, his idea to invite the girls, his idea to stop by the last party. At some point the night before, he got some mollies and took them. No one forced him to. That, for Murray, was still hard to believe.
Sully was not a drug user, Murray said over and over. They had lived together for almost a year, and Murray knew him inside and out. The guy did not use drugs. He was proud of his body, his stamina, his talent, and he was determined to become a star. Murray went along with the plan to deflect blame while not beating up on Sully, but he knew what was waiting for him at home. He knew that his parents would always feel that he had led Sully astray. He did not look forward to facing them alone. Murray called them every other hour. He called the funeral home in Durham. He found a funeral home director in Nassau and hired him. He called the airline to arrange the transfer of the body, $4,000 to ship it out, $2,000 to receive it at home. Arnie was covering all expenses. Murray worked the phones with a purpose, and he made calls out of boredom. Arnie was impressed. Late Sunday night, the police called to say the autopsy would take place in an expedited manner at 9 o'clock in the morning in Nassau. In the opinion of the chief detective, the autopsy was not that significant. The cause of death was obvious. He no longer believed foul play was involved, though his investigation would proceed until terminated. He said, "Looks like the young man had too much fun." Chapter 58. On Monday afternoon, Arnie and Reynard jetted back to Miami. They offered Murray a ride, but he politely said no. He needed to take his friend home. On Tuesday morning, he left Nassau on a Delta flight, his seat by the window. Somewhere below him in cargo, there was another passenger, his beloved friend, in a coffin. Sully loved to tell the stories of his trip from Juba to Orlando the summer before, how it was the first flight for every kid on the team, how they had been so excited they couldn't sleep the night before, how the trip took 30 hours, and by the time it was over, they were no longer infatuated with air travel. That was his first flight. This was his last. Murray began wiping his eyes before takeoff, and he put his sunglasses back on and wept. Regardless of how tough he acted in front of Arnie, he was blaming himself, and he knew he always would. And so would others. And there was nothing he could do to convince himself or anyone else that he had not failed Sully. He bit his lip to keep from sobbing, and he had never ached, physically and emotionally, so much in his life. On Wednesday, Ida and Ernie made the decision to hold the memorial service at the Nest. Central's president lobbied for this and finally convinced Ida that the school, and especially its students, wanted to pay their respects in a grand way. Ernie wanted a private ceremony at Sacred Heart Church with a quick burial afterward. At first, Ida seemed to lean that way, but Murray agreed with the president because he knew the students wanted to take part in the farewell. Murray was functioning well and taking care of the details. Ida was not. He posted a statement online announcing the service would be held at 3 p.m. Saturday afternoon at the gym, open to all. A private funeral mass would be held the following day at the church. Then he dealt with the press. Would it have access? Could the service be televised? Who would be speaking? Would there be music? And by whom? Murray battled away and had several conversations with campus security. The autopsy report contained no surprises. The illegal drug MDMA, an acronym for its chemical name, 3,4-methylenedioxymethamphetamine, and commonly known as ecstasy or Molly or any one of a dozen other street names, was present in the body. The one pill found in Sully's shorts was a tablet containing 120 milligrams of MDMA. At least two, and perhaps three, were taken in the 5 hours before death. The lab that made that tablet also added caffeine, ephedrine, and cocaine. His blood alcohol level was 0.20. The deceased was quite intoxicated. Marijuana was also present in the blood. His body temperature increased to a dangerous level and resulted in total kidney failure, the cause of death. Arnie's lawyers in Nassau succeeded in preventing the autopsy report from being released. The backboards were raised. The court was covered by rows of perfectly matched folding chairs, all filled. The gym was packed. The floor, the movable bleachers, the permanent seats, the aisles. The mourners sat still and somberly as a ladies' choir sang a soft funeral hymn. When they finished, there was a noise in the rear, and a door opened. A priest in a white robe appeared, and the casket was behind him. All 4,000 stood and turned to watch the procession. 8 eagles walked beside the casket, each with one hand on it. Behind, 2 by 2, were the rest of the team, then the coaches, led by Lonnie Britt, who held his wife's hand. Behind the coaches was the family, all of the walkers, Ida and Ernie first, Murray and Jordan, then Brady. The procession moved slowly down the center aisle as a string quartet played Amazing Grace. They parked Sully at the foot of a makeshift stage and below a pulpit borrowed from a church. The priest motioned for all to sit, and by the time the crowd settled in, women were sobbing. Another mournful hymn from the choir only rattled the emotions even more. Murray, out of frustration, had finally banned all cameras, except for ESPN. They had agreed to broadcast it live and share footage with other outlets. When Lonnie Britt walked to the podium, he knew he was facing a wide audience. He began with,
"Sully, Sully, by the time you said his name and saw that smile, you knew that you loved him."
With the composure, cadence, and preparation of a seasoned preacher, he talked about the kid from South Sudan. No one fought to hold back tears, including his coach. After another hymn, Murray stepped forward to struggle through a eulogy he still could not believe he was being called upon to give. He choked up, battled on, got a few laughs, and finally quit when he was overcome. He returned to his seat beside Ida, who patted his knee and whispered,
"Nice job. I love you."
On big screens, they ran a collage of Sully bantering with reporters, of him soaring through the air with unforgettable dunks, of him bombing away from midcourt. He never missed, and the crowd managed to cheer and cry at the same time.